The following presentation was recorded at the 1999 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
So, we have three volunteers. And one more back there. From the back. Thank you.
There's more coming in. Right
now. Oh, okay. This is such a huge subject that it is difficult to know where to start and where to stop. If somebody asks you to teach physics, do you know what to do? But when somebody asks you to teach children's literature, I said, well, what does that mean? What do you want me to do? Oh, I don't know. And I asked different people, what do you expect to get out of this class? You don't get much answer. So we kind of started from scratch, and we're going to have a good time. But the thing that amazes me is that we're all here. Isn't that kind of amazing? I mean, I would have never dreamed, well, it's been, is this 10 years prior? I'd have never dreamed 11 years ago that you would find me here. If somebody had said, I've been here in this study 11 years ago, I'd probably have. But here we are. And you're here, and it'd be interesting to know where you're all from, but we don't have time for all of that. So we're going to do some reading. We're going to look at the outline and we'll proceed. You know that the beginning is the most important part of any work, especially in the case of a young and tender thing. For that is the time in which the character is being formed and the desired impression is more readily taken. Shall we just carelessly allow children to hear any causal tales which may be devised by causal persons and to receive into their minds ideas, for the most part, the very opposite of those which we should wish them to have when they are grown up? We cannot. Anything received into the mind at that age is likely to become indelible and unalterable. I remember my father saying, you hear some nonsense ditty when you're 10 years old and it sticks with you the rest of your life. But you hear something good and it's a little harder to keep hold of. Isn't that amazing? And therefore, it is most important that the tales which the young first hear should be models of virtuous thoughts. Then will our youth dwell in a land of health, amid fair sights and sounds, and receive the good in everything and beauty. The effluence of fair works shall flow into their eyes and ears like a health-giving breeze from a purer region, and insensibly draw the soul from the earliest years into lightness and sympathy with the beauty of reason. That was written by Plato 350 years before Jesus was born. So this thing of what children read, and if they can read, is no new thing. It is a very, very old thing. If you would, you've all read this? And I'm still waiting for three seats to be filled. I don't want to forget that. If you've read this, I can erase it. Now, there may be one of them has Marvin Gish in it, that's my brother, or Barbara Gish, that's my wife. But if you have a book that doesn't have one of those, write my name in there, Edward Gish. I think they all do, but it's possible they don't. Because I don't want to lose any of those books. I brought them from home. If you would look at the syllabus in front of you, we want to introduce this course. And one way that we're going to introduce it is by taking a test right off the bat. How's that? Yes. Okay. Good. Every book If possible, I'd like for you to have books that you have not read. If you can trade with the person next to you, the whole set. I want to get the set. I'm prepared for reading what you're studying. I don't care if you trade books, but I want you to trade quote books. Now, some of you, like, has a Reader's Digest over here. There's a Reader's. The one that I want you to read in there is Congo Kidabu. If you've never read it, true story. Somebody has Shakespeare. The one that I'd like for you to read in there is King Henry IV. Have you ever read it? Can you read Shakespeare? There's a phrase in there that is worth knowing. We're going to talk about that kind of thing. Now, some of these books, I'm not saying that all these books that I gave you are acceptable. We're going to talk about that, but I want you to evaluate them on the basis of the criteria we will develop. And some of you, very likely, will come up with the conclusion that they're not acceptable reading for you. So don't think just because you have the book that I say that it's acceptable reading. I want to hand out this test. I want to do it first off, and I give you a chance to read them tonight. And as you take this test, there's room on the bottom. I want you to write on the bottom, and it doesn't say this. I want you to write on the bottom one thing that you expect to get out of this class. I have no idea what you expect to get out of this class. Seriously. If I was teaching physics, I'd know what you expect to get out of it. But I have no idea why you're here. Except maybe it's looking at it. So I'd appreciate it if you just write one thing that you would like to get out of this startup debate on Sunday afternoon. Bring up this subject. And you'll run into the whole spectrum. And what one person considers acceptable, another is appalled that anybody would read that book and not write it. And so one thing that we want to do, and we're going to run into this when we talk about the criteria, we're going to do some jigsawing, we're going to all get together, we're going to break up little groups. Probably happen tomorrow, doubt but we'll get to it today, although we might, I don't know how this is going to go. And we're going to develop all together a criteria for what's an acceptable book to read. And then you're going to read those books that you have based on that criteria. And that's one of the problems with pushing people that they can't agree on anything. So we're going to put that to a test, and we're going to agree, at least here and now, on what's an acceptable criteria for reading for young people. Now I want you to read those books on that basis. And I don't know how much time we'll have, but to me, one of the exciting parts will be is if each of you had time to get up and in 3 minutes give us a critique. Of one of those books. Now, whether you have time to do it or not, orally, I would like for you to do it in writing. That's what I can say. Another thing that I've learned about teachers, how many of you, is there anybody here that hasn't taught? Well, you've been around children. And you probably said it because I've said it. Your children say, oh, why do I need to know that? I mean, that's as old as people. Why do I need to know that? And I found that teachers are no different than children in that respect, too. You're going to go to a teacher seminar, and I've listened to this many, many times. Well, I don't think I'm going to go because I look at the subject, and I don't think there's anything there that pertains to me. Anybody ever said that, thought that, heard that? Well, let me tell you something that I've learned. And you tell me if I'm wrong, but I've learned anywhere you go, you can learn something worthwhile if you want to. If you've got a mindset that I'm going to go and I'm going to learn something, then you're going to learn something. I don't care where you go, but if you have a mindset that I'm not going to learn anything, you're not going to learn anything. No different than children. You ever try to make a child learn they want to? That's a tough job. It's a hard job making them learn when they want to. And I just want to encourage you. We had a in Sacramento, ASCI, had a seminar on for preschool teachers. And I don't teach preschool, I teach high school. It was on Saturday, and so I told our teachers, I said, let's go. Well, there was more than one of them said, I think, that's great. Well, that's all. You don't have to go if you don't want to. I'm one. So how many of us went? Six? Eight? Six or eight of us went? You, were you gone?
I think Marnie's ready.
Oh, that's right. He's a normal way. Marnie's going to get to go.
There was six of you.
I think six of us. One of them, who right at the last minute said she wasn't going, I don't need to learn one more thing about teaching. She's talked all the time. But at the last minute, she decided to go. And I know why I was going. I have to go. I went to the first session, and I said, it was worth the trip to be in the session. It was what I learned from this preschool teacher. And we're going to share some of that, some of the things we're going to talk about, the things I learned from her. I want to encourage you, wherever you go, you can learn, you won't learn. If you don't want to learn, you won't learn. But when I was going to college, actually I'm a civil engineer. This is what I went to college for. I had a degree in civil engineering. And I can remember standing outside engineering classes and you guys standing around saying, this class, I don't think we're learning anything in this class. I'm not sure this professor knows anything. No. One day I asked these fellows, I said, you know, how'd you guys get so smart in one of these dumb classes? That's really what it matters. Yeah. And the thing of it is, and I've thought about that a lot, the thing of it is, and that's what Isaiah said, how do you learn about the Lord? Did you learn everything you know about the Lord in a day, a month, a week, a year? No. It's line upon line, precept upon precept, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little. That's the way you learn. If you go someplace, you have to learn one thing before you learn. That's the way we learn. So if I could just tickle the gray matter in your cranium a little bit, puncture the pericardium in your chest cavity just a little bit, maybe work with feet. That's what we're here for. And we can learn. Now nothing would thrill me more, and I don't expect a stampede and everybody standing up at once, but nothing would thrill me more than if somewhere along the line in this week, somebody would stand up and say, and I don't care if I'm in the middle of a sentence, and say, I would like to read something. I can't hold it in any longer. Wouldn't that be neat? Wouldn't you like to hear somebody read something that wanted to read it and couldn't hold it in any longer? And isn't that really what happens when you read the Bible and read about Jeremiah? I mean, God's message was just like a burning on his lips. He couldn't keep it anymore. He had to say something. And think about that. Don't put it all on me. I'm going to learn as much this week as you are, maybe more. I really believe that. I didn't reflect all these, did I? Do we have them all? Now, if I were filling that out, they'd have been all true. But I admit that I would have to qualify some of them. So that's not quite fair, maybe. But I want to look at those. For instance, I will read a book, and I do not object to, and some of it may depend on whether you're talking about sixth graders or tenth graders, but I will approve of a book that has a bad word or two in it, as long as the bad word is not uttered in the context of acceptability. That makes a difference. Because there's bad words in the Bible. You knew that. There's words that we wouldn't say in the Bible. So we have to be careful, or we will develop a criteria that there's parts of the Bible we wouldn't read. Before you move on, let me tell you just a few things
give you a small map in case you get lost. When you're about to read, what you're about to read was written over many years, a little bit at a time, and addressed to friends, family, a religious community, and myself with no thought of publication in book form. I don't know what to call it. I think of it as my stuff. A written report about what goes on in my head and life. A part of this, the part about what I learned in kindergarten, was passed around the country until it took on a life all of its own. How many of you ever read this book? Robert Fulghum. Okay. One day it was sent home from school in the knapsack of a child whose mother is a literary agent, and she wrote to me. Did I have anything else I'd written? Well, yes, and one thing led to another in a wonderland sort of way. So here's more stuff in a book, pretty much as it was written. I did change some names and facts to protect those who are either innocent or crabby or both. And another thing, there are contradictions in here. You may be reading along and think, didn't he just say the opposite of that a few pages back? Yes, it's just that I seem to hold in my head some mutually exclusive notions. For example, it's true that the unexamined life is not worth living, and true that ignorance is bliss, and so on. I haven't made up my mind about anything yet. But what else to tell you? Read a little at a time. There's no hurry and no resolution of the plot at the end. Finally, I shall tell you that I have an official storyteller's license. A friend made it up and taped it to the wall over my desk. This license gives me permission to use my imagination in rearranging my experience to improve a story, so long as it serves some notion of truth. It also contains the storyteller's creed. Here's the creed. I believe that imagination is stronger than knowledge, that myth is more potent than history, that dreams are more powerful than facts, that hope always triumphs over experience, that laughter is the only cure for grief, and I believe that love is stronger than death. I've tried very hard to not write anything that would cause my license to be revoked. Each spring for many years, I've set myself the task of writing a personal statement of belief, a credo. When I was younger, the statement ran for many pages, trying to cover every base with no loose ends. It sounded like a Supreme Court brief, as if words could resolve all the conflicts about the meaning of existence. The credo has grown shorter in recent years, sometimes cynical, sometimes comical, sometimes bland, but I keep working on it. Recently, I set out to get the statement of personal belief down to one page in simple terms, fully understanding the idealism that implied. The inspiration for brevity came to me at a gasoline station. I managed to fill an old car's tank with super deluxe high-octane go juice. My old hoopie couldn't handle it and got the willies, kept sputtering out at intersection, belching, going downhill. I understood. My mind and my spirit get like that from time to time. Too much high-content information, and I get the existential willies. Keep sputtering out at intersections where life's choices must be made, and I either know too much or not enough. The examined life is no picnic. I realized then that I already knew what most of what's necessary to live a meaningful life, that it isn't all that complicated. I know it and have known it for a long, long time. Living it? Well, that's another story. Yet, here's my credo. All I really need to know about how to live and what to do and how to be, I learned in kindergarten. Wisdom was not at the top of the graduate school mountain, but there in the sand pile at Sunday school. These are the things I learned. Share everything. Play fair. Don't hit people. Put things back where you found them. Clean up your own mess. Don't take things that aren't yours. Say you're sorry when you hurt somebody. Wash your hands before you eat. Warm cookies and cold milk are good for you. Live a balanced life. Learn some, think some, and draw and paint and sing and dance and play and work every day some. Take a nap every afternoon. When you go out into the world, watch out for traffic, hold hands, and stick together. Be aware of wonder. Remember the little seed in the styrofoam cup? The roots go down, the plant goes up, and nobody really knows how or why. But we're all like that. Goldfish and hamsters and white mice and even the little seed in the styrofoam cup, they all die. So do we. And then remember the Dick and Jane books and the first word you learned, the biggest word of all, look. Everything you need to know is in there somewhere. The golden rule and love and basic sanitation, ecology, politics, equality, and sane living. Take any one of these items and extrapolate it into the sophisticated adult terms and apply it to your family life or your work or your government or your world, and it holds true and clear and firm. Think what a better world it would be if we all, the whole world, had cookies and milk about 3 o'clock every afternoon and lay down with their blankies for a nap. Or if all the government had as its basic policy to always put things back where they found them and to clean up their own mess. And it's still true. No matter how old you are, when you go out into the world, it's best to hold hands and stick together. And on and on. If you're teaching sixth grade arithmetic, maybe history, there can be an argument made that that is not real critical to a person's spiritual life, and it won't enhance his chances, journey, testimony, whatever word you want to put in there, of going to heaven, whether he gets a C or an A on that sixth grade math or history. You could make a pretty good argument for that, couldn't you? Downing learning. But if you think about it, and I admit that I have not thought about it until Milo called me. By the way, I know you shouldn't give a disclaimer, but I think Milo called me 3 times before I agreed to do this. I said, I don't know who's on call, but I want to get somebody else. And finally said, that's what everybody said. Everybody I talked to said, get somebody else. So, in a weak moment, and without talking to my wife, anyway, here I am. But I got thinking about it, and do you know that the most important thing, and I know it's dangerous to say one thing is the most important thing, but I'm going to tell you today that the most important thing for a child to do is to learn to read. And it's been said, if a child doesn't learn to read the Bible, there's no point in learning to read. Think about that. If he doesn't learn to read the Bible, there's no point in learning to read. And I did not realize that the Bible said so much about reading. If I ask you, what does the Bible say about learning fractions? What would you say? If you show me a scripture in the Bible that says there's a blessing in learning fractions. Now, obviously, math is my first love academically, and I'm not putting down learning fractions, but let's be honest. What does the Bible say about the blessing of learning fractions? It doesn't say anything that I've ever learned. So what I would like to do right here in the beginning is establish the fact that teaching a child to read and appreciate good books is critical, is essential in his spiritual life and his eternal destiny. I guess if I don't read anything, I believe that. Once I realized that, I looked around at children that had a hard time reading, and they have a hard time with a lot of things. A lot of the first thing I did was I picked up a Strong's Pine Gordons and a Vines, and I looked up these words read, and I forget now there's some 400 or 500 references to reading in the Bible. Writing and that associated thing. That shocked me just a little. And then I looked up the Greek word. Is there anything here we need to talk about? We've done it. Right? Anybody? We're all happy? You're not happy? Everybody happy? Then I looked up the Greek word to read, the infinitive phrase of the verb. And to my surprise, I knew what the word. The Greek word genosko, I've been familiar with that for a long time.
The Greek word genosko means to know. It doesn't mean head knowledge. It means to know intimately. It means to know in the heart. It has the meaning of having a relationship with. If you know me, we have a relationship. We're friends. It means more than you just know my name. And so in John 17:3, when Jesus said, "This is life eternal, that I might know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom thou hast sent," he knew what he was saying. He was saying that it's life eternal to have a relationship with Jesus Christ. Not just to know, oh yeah, he lived 2,000 years ago, or what is it, 2,000 years then, but for us now. Not just to know who he was. And that's true. The gospel in a nutshell. That's life eternal. To have a relationship, genosko, Jesus Christ. The prefix anna means again. And lo and behold, that's to read, to know again. And they're fine. You see, you can only read what somebody else has already known. You can think maybe a new thought, but if you read something, somebody else already knows. And so we're going to look at some scriptures. I just want to convince you that the most important thing that you will do as a teacher is to read to your children and get them interested in good literature. It will change their life. It will change their life. And it's amazing to me. See, in the last 6 months, I put all this together in my head. I had a teacher in the fifth grade that had been like, her name was Mrs. Hawk. Probably the reason I remember her name. I didn't like her. And a lot of kids didn't like her. I'm not saying that we all treated her right, but she wasn't a good teacher. But the amazing thing is she read us a book. The name of it was The Red Tracker. I remember the name of the book. I don't remember anything. How much do I remember of what happened when I was in fifth grade? I can't remember anything else I remember. But I remember this teacher that didn't like. Read us the book, The Red Tracker. And she would read a chapter every Friday afternoon. And I still, and I thought about it, you know, I don't have any bad feelings about that teacher. And I had tremendously, right over here is an empty seat. You take that, I can go ahead. Thank you. Oh, that there's books up there. It's because I like that book. I remember being fascinated. I still remember what the book was about. And that's fascinating to me that she read it to us. And somehow, I think she kind of won my heart, even though I didn't like it. I can't figure that out, really, in one way. But it shows the importance of reading. And so we want to look at some scripture and convince you that you can change a child's life by reading. I have so much stuff up there to read that we try to spend all week reading. Go around and do that, but periodically we will. When I was a boy, just one more thing, then we'll get into some scriptures. Is that all right? We'll do that as a basis. If I could digress, now we're two steps away from the scriptures. This year, we're high school. We had a lady who was an expert in Christian sex education come in. And the interesting thing to me was that how many high schoolers said that what they wanted was a scriptural base for what she said. And that's why they liked it, was the scriptural base. And I thought about that in reference to this class. So I want to give you a scriptural base. Now, when I was a teenager, we used to sing a song a lot. How many of you know what you not temptation? Do you all know that? God say, I'm going to say what followed it, but I would say that song had a profound effect on my life. I even sing that song with any meaning and not internal. There's something about that song that resists me trying to apply it to somebody else. It kind of forces you to apply it to yourself. Isn't that amazing? I don't know why the person who wrote it, I have no idea what kind of person it was. The songs we sang, the stories we read, can have a profound effect on a child's life.
Anagnosko, to know again. So to read the Bible, and that's why God puts a blessing on reading, it's to know what God already knows. It's to know what God knows. Anagnosko, to know again. God knows it, I read His Word, and now I know it. Isn't that amazing? Now I know it. Maybe at 2:30 we'll take a break, if somebody would remind me. Would you remind me, 2:30? Just holler at me or do something. There's a saying that in the land of the blind, the one-eyed is king. And a corollary of that would be, in the land of the illiterate, the person that can read is king. I think at the end of your outline, there is a saying, I think I put it on there, let me check. Toward the end. Yeah, all knowledge is a spendable commodity depending on the market. The more you know about a great many things, the greater testimony you're going to have for the Lord. Think about Paul, and he obviously had read Cretan literature, so he could say, your own prophets, your own writers have said the Cretans are always liars. You see, he used that information that he knew about their secular literature to promote the gospel. That's true in many, many ways. That's what boggled the Pharisees' mind, was the idea that they knew that Jesus had never gone to school. And that was a big thing with them. That was a relatively rare thing for somebody to go to school, and certainly for somebody with his background, with his social setting. And not only had he gone to school and learned to read, but when they would attack him, he would bring up details about their own law that refuted them. He knew the old Bible in detail. So he could say, well, didn't you ever read about what David did? And that just rattled their cage tremendously. That this man only knew how to read, but he had read and retained in such detail that he was forever bringing up things that countered their hypocrisy. And so we can look at some of these scriptures. God could write, Moses could read. Now, even when I was a younger man, they used to say that there was something wrong there, that people couldn't read and write back when Moses lived, and they've obviously since given that up. We don't want to look at a lot of these. That would be true in Exodus 24:7, where the law was written by the finger of God, and then remember those tables were broken and the second set was made. But God had Moses write them. In Nehemiah 8:8, in fact, let's just look there. We're going to look at a few of these. I don't know how many of you have your Bibles. I didn't tell you to bring them. Nehemiah 8:8. So they read in the book of the law distinctly. That means they just didn't read it and pass over it. I don't think they read it and said, so they read in the book of the law distinctly and gave the sense and guessed that. It says they read in the book of the law distinctly and gave the sense. In other words, they explained what it meant and caused them to understand the reading. And you think about it, by the same token, if a child doesn't learn to read the Bible, there's no use in learning to read. By the same token, you can say, if a child doesn't learn to read the meaning of what he reads, there's no point in reading. Right? I mean, they read a
chapter or a story in their soul studies, supposed to answer some questions about it, and have no idea what they read. So it's important that we teach them to understand. We're going to look at some techniques to help them with their comprehension.
There's something disturbing about reading something and not understanding it. And we don't want to turn there, but like in Jeremiah 31, 33, along there in Jeremiah, it says a time is coming. See, he had written his law on the tables of stone, and Moses had written it on probably scrolls and things. But he says there's a time coming when I'm going to write my law on their heart. They've got to understand inside what I'm talking about. A whole different level of reading. And that is the level that we're talking about. They need to understand. Not because we want to hammer this into them, but the exciting part of it is when a child understands what they read and they really get themselves into the book, whatever it is. I can remember when I was probably 10, 12 years old reading Tom Sawyer, laying up on my bed, and I was so involved in that thing that I remember they couldn't get me to come down for supper. I mean, that's very real to me. They have to call me 3 times for supper. I'd rather read Tom Sawyer. I was laughing for a while. I love to read Mark Twain. Now, one thing that you can do, the mind can run 10 times faster than my mouth. Did you know that? I mean, look, seriously. How many things can you think about while you're sitting here listening to me? So I'm going to give you a saying. It's my favorite non-Bible saying. And so while I'm talking, I want you to think about it. And that's one of the things that we're going to look at. A child learns more when their mind is occupied with something relevant to the story. So you think about this, and before the day ends, I'll tell you who said it. Disturbing about seeing writing and not understanding it, consider Belshazzar, the writing on the wall. The finger upset him. But if you read that account, what really upset him is he didn't know what it was saying. You ever pick up a foreign book written in a foreign language you didn't understand? It's frustrating, isn't it? I mean, you have no idea what in the world this person's talking about. So there's several references to that in Daniel, for instance, in that account. In Revelation, there's a couple references to that. One, there's a blessing on understanding the book. And if you'll remember in Revelation 5, there's the incident where this book was brought forth before all these people, and nobody could open it and read it. Remember what John did? He cried. Anybody remember who read it? Who opened it and read it? Jesus Christ, the Lamb of God. There's something disturbing about something being written that you at least suspect is for your good or written to you, and you can't understand it. We have a brother in our congregation that writes to me all the time, and it might as well be in Chinese. I can't read it. And boy, I've spent a lot of time, and it's frustrating to try to read this. And you can't understand it. In Matthew, when Jesus is talking about the end of the world, Matthew 24, he says, whoever reads this, let him understand. And people have been trying pretty hard to understand. Consider the eunuch in Acts 8. He was reading out of Isaiah 53, and he was reading this, and Philip jumped up there in that chariot, and And the eunuch said, who's he talking about? Is he talking about himself or somebody else? He didn't understand what he was reading. He needed somebody to explain it to him. And so children need to understand, and there's an enjoyment in doing that. When they understand what they're reading, they enjoy it. They get into it. They want to read more. You realize that you can go anywhere in the world, anytime, in a book. Isn't that amazing? Cheapest travel there is. So when Jesus read, it rattled them. How he learned, they couldn't figure it out. In 1 Timothy 4, 12 and 13, he gives a blessing there on reading. We'll look at a few of these and then we're going to move on. Let no man despise thy youth, but be thou an example of the believer in word, in conversation, in charity, in spirit, and faith, and purity. Till I come, give attendance to reading, that's knowing what God has written, to exhortation, and to doctrine. There's various commands. We're just scratching the surface. There are a lot of commandments in the Bible to read. So when we're teaching a child to read, we're teaching them really a Bible commandment. And that's not true, I don't believe, of most of the other disciplines, although reading is definitely used, and maybe that's why, is used in the other disciplines. Hebrews 10:16 gives the ultimate goal of God in a writing. Hebrews 10:16. This is the covenant that I will make with them after those days, saith the Lord. I'll put my law into their hearts, and in their minds will I write them. See, there's no value in reading the Bible if it isn't internalized, if it isn't in your mind and in your heart. And that's what we want to encourage you to do with the children that you teach. And I think it's difficult. I really do. And we could read all kinds of examples. But let's just think a little bit. Why do children like to read or like you to read to them? Do you ever wonder about that? Why do they enjoy that? Well, and you can make it very complicated, but they want to fulfill or experience through books, through something else, a need for physical well-being. And that's why, if you think about it, you read books, and some of the books that I have there are older books, books in the past, Cinderella, stories, all kinds of stories. If you read older books, let's say stories and books that were written 100 years or more ago, they extol clothes, nice clothes, food, and nice homes. Because most children, 100, 200 years ago, did not have that even in the United States. And so to have nice clothes, all the food that you want to eat, and a nice home to live in, was a picture of heaven. And when you think about it, that's what those books tend to do. And you see, I think that's why the modern books lack some of that. Because what are you going to push in a book today when most of the children around us have what? All the clothes they want, all the food they want to eat, and a nice home to live in. So now what are they going to push? So things are extolled more than excesses, is what I'm trying to say. But children have a natural desire for physical well-being. And they find that in books. It's no accident that those stories of old started out with once upon a time. And how did they end? Lived happily ever after. Who doesn't want to live happily ever after? Does that make a child feel secure to live happily ever after? Would you read a child a story that didn't end with living happily ever after?
No, they wouldn't want to. They wouldn't want to listen to that kind of book.
So children like to be read to because it fulfills their need for a physical well-being. Coupled with that is security. They want security, so stories are entwined around a homey fireplace or a father and a mother. Even Peter Rabbit. There's something kind of homey about Peter Rabbit and all those little bunnies having a little nest and they can run home to mama. See, there's a theme, there is a purpose in all these stories. Children want to be loved. They have a great desire to be loved. That's why I think they love animal stories. Because an animal is a non-threatening thing. And so they play with children, and there may be rejection there, there may be some squabbles, but if they pet their kitty or they pet their dog, it's non-threatening. They always get love back. And they like that. So children naturally like animals. Isn't that amazing? Why? Because there's an inborn need to be loved. And really, that's the story of the gospel. That kind of makes it an open door because that's the story of Jesus Christ who loves us. And so in a very real natural way, a child's heart is an open door to the gospel. We'll just put something worthwhile through the door. Isn't that amazing? And of course, once other things get through the door, quick, they don't want that other.
Remember what even Plato said. The first thing that goes there is the thing that sticks the best. You know, I could never figure that out.
I remember thinking, here's this boy. Pick on the boys. Here's this boy. He's in sixth grade, and he's never learned his math facts. Well, he's older now. He ought to be able to take the math cards, and with a little bit of time, we can sit down and learn his math facts. Not so, right? How many of you have tried that? Why? Because he already has a resistance built up for them. He's already put something else in there in place of those math facts. He's already got it cranked into his being that he can't learn them. So before you can teach this sixth grade boy his math facts, you've got to tear that wall down and then start in. So you got twice as big a job as you had before. And it's no different with bad literature versus good literature. What goes in there first? He's going to stick the hearts.
How many parents do you think there are today that would say, if you could talk to them and they were honest, they would say, you know, I can't talk to my teenager anymore, won't listen to me. And there was a time in that child's life when he went to crawl up on his mom and dad's lap and had a story read to him, and it was good. I mean, and then the parent comes along 10, 15 years later, and went, oh, this kid won't listen to me. No mystery to me at all. No mystery to me at all. First thing that goes in there, when they're a child, and I admit to you, there was a time when I, people say, well, people are, and they have all these hang-ups when they get to be adults, and this idea that they're anchored in their childhood. But you know what? It's not. It's not. It absolutely isn't. And when I really was honest and thought about it myself, I could see myself in that.
The first thing that goes in there is the most important thing. They're motivated by hope. Children's stories, particularly the very young, but even later stories, they always come out right. There's always that carrot of hope hanging out there, and it turns out okay. That's why they like to read. Children want to have hope. They want to think that in the end, everything's going to turn out all right. They have a need to belong, and that's why you see the overriding theme in that book of Heidi. Who has that Heidi book? The overriding theme in that book of Heidi is she didn't have parents, she wanted to belong, and she was in conflict whether to belong in the city or in the mountains.
She was a little girl,
wanted to belong. She had a burning desire. I mean, she would run up the mountains to Grandpa and throw her arms around him. But she had to tear herself away from all the little girls. I'm not going to say anything more. Anyway.
The book of Ruth, the story of Ruth in the Bible. She wanted to belong. She was looking for a people. She knew she didn't fit among her own, and so she was going to seek it among the people of God. She was willing to risk all for the people of God to belong. They want to fantasize in books, children can make the world what they wish it was. And the last thing, and then we'll go for break.
When you read to a child or read to a class, your attention is focused on them. And it's particularly true when it's one-on-one. You take my grandchild, or, I can't help but mention this, I've got a 2-year-old great-granddaughter. When you read to them, and they're sitting on your lap, you got all their attention. Now, obviously, they don't consciously think about all that. But you're not talking to them while you're doing the dishes or counting nails or whatever. When you're reading to them, they have all your attention. And there's a time to feed, you might call it that selfish need, giving your attention so they know that they have it. They need to know that they're important to you. They need to know that they don't need to know that Dad is so tired of reading about the red caboose that he thinks if he reads that story once more, he's going to lose his mind. Isn't that amazing how they like to have a story read over and over and over and over again? Now, I'll tell you one story about that. Okay, great. I'm reading to my children. They were not very old. Read the books. I don't know how many times I read it. And they knew it by heart. They would say a sentence before you got there. About in the middle of it, Barbara called us to supper. We went to supper. When we came back, and I opened the book up. It just happened that I opened it up one page beyond where it was. Okay. One last page. I mean, I still remember that as clear as anything. And I read the whole rest of the book, and our old scholar Phyllis, she never said a word until I got to the end, and she said, "Daddy, you skipped a page." I couldn't believe it. I would have guaranteed that she didn't know, because we eat supper between. We have it. But see, they know, and that was important to her. She didn't like it, but I skipped a page. She knew what the page said. And she wanted to hear it and read it to her. I was totally fascinated by that.
So it's important that you give them their attention. Reading is important. Let's take a break. 10 minutes? Questions? Now, you're not going to be this quiet all week, I hope. If you was sixth graders, we'd be trying to quiet you down. And now we're trying to get you to talk. You need to participate, right? You've heard Grace read about participate. How many of you have read Grace read the story about participating? No more than that. I'll have her come read it, huh, Linda? No questions? No comments? Does everybody have a set of books and whatnot that wants one? Todd, do you need any books? Well, I had 2 books at every place. Do you want 2 books? Okay. Here we are. Anybody else? I noticed in one of the tests somebody put how to get children to read or motivating them to read. I remember in the beginning, at one point, I would have a good book that I thought the high schoolers ought to read, and I would say, this is a good book.
Who's somebody reading? We live the land.
And then for some reason, I got to thinking about that one day.
And I learned how to get them to read. And so I pick out some students that I knew would read. And I'd say, Mary, would you read this book? And tell us what you think of it. And if you want to, you know, read somebody else. First thing I know, I'd say, what did you do that book? Oh, I gave it to them. And I'd go, oh, I gave it to them. Then you go make friends. See, they'll read it if she says it's a good book. But if the teacher says it's a good book, that's suspicious. What's his motive? In fact, I'm glad I brought that up. That book you have right there, would some boy, I want a boy to read that book, would some boy trade with her, unless you want to read it? Would some boy trade with her? Oh, there we go.
Finally won, didn't you?
But you got to promise you'll read that book.
That is a hard job getting boys to read that book.
Not very successful. You all know James Michener? Heard of him at least, haven't you? Well, lo and behold, he wrote this book on sports in America. And I would have never believed that he would have written this book. And he says, sports is the god of America. He roundly condemns where America is. So now you know why boys don't want to read it.
But he's right. Man's a deacon in a Baptist church in Philadelphia. And on Sunday, the, what's the Philadelphia ball game? Do they even have one? Am I picking the wrong city? Huh?
The Phillies.
They're playing ball. But he's a deacon in the Baptist church. Anybody want to guess where he is on Sunday morning?
So who's this guy? He goes through. Man, that's a joke.
I made that up, but it's close to what's in there. I mean, I might have the wrong team. I don't know. True story. Now let me tell you about Larry Walters, my hero. Walters is a truck driver, 33 years old. He's sitting in his lawn chair in his backyard wishing he could fly. For as long as he could remember, he wanted to go up. To just rise right up in the air and see for a long way. The time, money, education, opportunity to be a pilot were not his. Hang gliding was too dangerous and any good place for gliding was too far away. So he spent a lot of summer afternoons sitting in his backyard in his ordinary old aluminum lawn chair, the kind with the webbing and the rivets, just like the one you've got in your backyard. The next chapter in his story is carried by the newspapers and television. There's old Larry Walters up in the air over Los Angeles, flying at last, really getting up there, sitting in his aluminum lawn chair, but it's hooked to 45 helium-filled surplus weather balloons. Larry has a parachute on, a CB radio, six-pack of beer, some peanuts, some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and a BB gun to pop the balloons to come down. Instead of being just a couple of hundred feet over his neighborhood, though, he shot up 11,000 feet right through the approach corridor to the Los Angeles International Airport. Walder is a taciturn man. You know what that means? You see, when I'm reading to students, usually I tell them, now, if I come to a word you don't know, I'm going to stop.
Well, usually they will. And we're going to talk about all this later. If they don't, then I stop. And I say, you know what that word means? Not really. So then I have them guess from the context, reread the sentence, and it's amazing. They usually kind of figure it out.
I'm not going to tell you what the word means. You can look it up. Taciturn. When asked by the press why he did it, he said, you can't just sit there. When asked if he was scared, he answered, wonderfully so. When asked if he would do it again, he said, nope. Asked if he was glad that he did it, he grinned from ear to ear and said, oh, yes. The human race sits in its chair. On the one hand is the message that says there's nothing left to do. and the Larry Walterses of the earth are busy tying balloons to their chairs, directed by dreams and imagination to do their thing. The human race sits in its chair. On the one hand is the message that the human situation is hopeless, and the Larry Walterses of the earth soar upward knowing anything is possible, sending back the message from 11,000 feet. I did it. I really did it. I am flying. It's the spirit here that counts. The time may be long, the vehicle may be strange or unexpected, but if the dream is held close to the heart and imagination is applied to what there is close at hand, everything is possible. But wait, some cynic from the edge of the crowd insists that human beings still can't really fly. Not like birds, anyway. True, but somewhere in some little garage, some maniac with a gleam in his eye is scarfing vitamins and mineral supplements and practicing flapping his arms faster and faster. Lots of stories. Now, some of you are going to have to bear with me. You've probably heard me read some of these before. Now, this is a book. Anybody ever read any Anastasia Krupnik books? Didn't think you had. You have? There's several of them, a whole series of them. They're not all the same author, but you know that? Some of them's one author and some's another. I wouldn't particularly recommend this book to children to read, but to me, it's an example of the story I'm going to read you. To me, is one of the most fantastic stories I've ever read. It's just a little piece out of this book. So many times, teachers, it's all right to collect books that you wouldn't want your children to read because there's one little thing in them you like or you want. Whatever. You could argue that this is not a good book. Well, listen to this story, though. And this applies to all teachers. I learned a lot from reading this story. Mrs. Westvessel, that's the teacher in the story, was very, very, very fond of weeks. In their class, already this year, they had Be Kind to Animals Week when the bulletin board had been filled with newspaper clippings about dogs who had found lost children in deep woods, cats that had traveled 300 miles home after being left behind in strange cities, and a cow in New Hampshire that had been spray-painted red during hunting season so that she would not be mistaken for a deer. During My Neighborhood Week, one entire class... I'm supposed to stand behind this mic. One entire classroom wall had been covered with paper on which they had made a mural. Each child had drawn a building to create My Neighborhood. There were three pieces, two movie theaters, both showing Superman, one Red Sox stadium, a split-level house with a horse tied to a tree in the yard, two aquariums, two science museums, one airport control tower, three state prisons, and a condemned apartment building with a large rat in the front steps. Mrs. Westvessel said that it was not what she had in mind, and the next time she would give better instructions about the rat on the steps. Creativity Week was the week that the fourth grade was to bring their poems to school. On Monday morning, Mrs. Westvessel took them on a field trip to Longfellow's home on Brattle Street. On Tuesday afternoon, a lady poet, poetess, she should be called according to Mrs. Westvessel, but the lady poet frowned and said she preferred poet, please, come to visit the class and read some of her poems. The lady poet wore dark glasses and had crimson fingernails. Anastasia didn't think that Longfellow would have liked the lady poet at all, or her poems. Wednesday was the day that the members of the class were to read their own poems aloud. Robert Giannini stood in front of the class and read, "I have a dog named Spot. He likes to eat and drink a lot. When I put water in his dish, he laps it up just like a fish." Anastasia hated Robert Giannini's poem. Also, she thought it was a lie. Robert Giannini's dog was named Sputnik. Everyone in the neighborhood knew that, and Sputnik had bitten two kids during the summer, and if he bit one more person, the police said that the Giannini's would have to get rid of him. But Mrs. Westvessel cried, "Wonderful!" She gave Robert Giannini an A and hung his poem on the wall. Anastasia imagined that Longfellow was eyeing it with distaste. Tracy Beckwith got up from her desk, straightened her tights carefully, and read, "In autumn when the trees are brown, I like to walk all through the town. I like to see the birds fly south. Some have worms still in their mouths." Tracy Beckwith blushed, hung her head, and said, "It didn't rhyme exactly." "Well," said Mrs. Westvessel in a kind voice, "your next one will be better, I'm sure." She gave Tracy Beckwith a B+, hung the poem on the wall next to Robert's. Anastasia had begun to feel a little funny, as if she had ginger ale in her knees. But it was her turn. She stood up in front of the class and read her poem. Her voice was very small because she was nervous. And I should write it on here. It's written, "Hush, And then Big Cat.
Hush, hush, the sea soft night is a swim with wrinkle squirm characters. Listen. I don't know if you can see back there, but it's all spaced out to look like a worm. To them, move smooth in the mistly, moistly dark, here in the whisper warm, wet. That was Anastasia's poem.
Oh, read that again, please, Anastasia, in a bigger voice, said Mrs. Westvessel. So Anastasia took a deep breath and read her poem again. She used the same kind of voice that her father did when he read poetry to her, drawing some of the words out as long as licorice sticks and making others thumpingly short. The class laughed. Mrs. Westvessel looked puzzled. Let me see that poem, Anastasia, she said. Anastasia gave her the poem. Mrs. Westvessel's ordinary, everyday face had about 100 wrinkles in it. When she looked at Anastasia's poem, her forehead and nose folded up so that she had 200 new wrinkles all of a sudden. Where are your capital letters, Anastasia? Asked Mrs. Westvessel. Anastasia didn't say anything. Where is the rhyme? Asked Mrs. Westvessel. It doesn't rhyme at all. Anastasia didn't say anything. What kind of poem is this, Anastasia? Asked Mrs. Westvessel. Can you explain it, please? Anastasia's voice had become very small again, the way voices do sometimes. It's a poem of sounds, she said. It's about little things that live in tide pools after dark when they move around. It doesn't have sentences or capital letters because I wanted it to look on the page like small creatures moving in the dark. I don't know why it doesn't rhyme, she said, miserably. It didn't seem important. Anastasia, weren't you listening in class when we talked about writing poems? Anastasia looked at the floor. No, she whispered. Mrs. Westvessel frowned, rubbed her jiggly arm thoughtfully. Well, she said at last. Well, Anastasia, when we talked about poetry in this class, we simply were not talking about worms and snails crawling on a piece of paper. I'm afraid I'll have to give you an F. An F? Anastasia had never had an F in her entire life. She kept looking at the floor. Someone had stepped on a red crayon once. The color was smeared into the wood forever. I worked very hard on that poem, whispered Anastasia. Speak up, Anastasia. Anastasia lifted her head and looked at Miss Westvessel in the eye. I worked very, very hard on that poem, she said in a loud, clear voice. Mrs. Westvessel looked terribly sad. I can tell that you did, Anastasia, she said. But the trouble is, you didn't listen to the instructions. I gave very, very careful instructions to the class about the kind of poem you were to write. And you were here that day. I remember you were here. Now, if in geography I explained to the class just how to draw a map and someone didn't listen and drew his own kind of a map, everybody glanced at Robert Gianetti, who blushed. He'd drawn a beautiful map of Ireland with cartoon figures of people throwing bombs all over it and had gotten an F. Even though it was a very beautiful map, I would have to give that person a failing grade because he didn't follow the instructions. So I'm afraid I'll have to do the same in this case, Anastasia. I'm sorry, said Mrs. Westvessel. I'll just bet you are, thought Anastasia. If you work hard on another, perhaps it'll be better. I'm sure it will be better, said Mrs. Westvessel. She wrote a large F on the page of poetry, gave it back to Anastasia, and called on the next student. At home that evening, Anastasia got her green notebook out of her desk drawer. Solemnly, under "These are the things most important that happened the year I was 10," in item 3, she crossed out the word "wonderful" and replaced it with the word "terrible." I wrote a terrible poem, she read sadly. Her goldfish, Frank, came to the side of the bowl and moved his mouth. Anastasia read his lips and said, "Blurp, blurp, blurp," to you too, Frank. Then she turned the pages to her notebook until she came to a blank one, page 14, and printed carefully at the top of the right-hand side, "Things I hate." She thought very, very hard because she wanted it to be an honest list. Finally, she wrote down Mr. Belden in the drugstore. Anastasia honestly hated Mr. Belden because he called her girly and because once, in front of a whole group of fifth grade boys who were buying baseball cards, he had said the rottenest, rudest thing she could imagine anyone ever saying, and especially in front of a whole group of fifth grade boys. Mr. Belden had said, "You want some cover-up cream for those freckles, girly?" And she had not been anywhere near the cover-up freckle cream, which is $1.39 and right between the cuticure soap and the absorbing junior. Next, without any hesitation, Anastasia wrote down boys. She honestly hated boys. All the fifth grade boys buying baseball cards that day had laughed. Liver was also on the honest list. Everyone in the whole world hated liver except her parents. And she wrote down pumpkin pie after some thought. She tried to like pumpkin pie, but she honestly hated it. And finally, Anastasia wrote at the end of her things I hate list, Mrs. Westvessel. That was the most honest thing of all. Then to even off the page, she made a list on the left-hand side, things I love. For some reason, that was a lot easier to do. Her parents were having coffee in the living room. They're going to find out about that F when they go for a parent-teacher conference, thought Anastasia, so I might as well show them. She took her poem to the living room. She held it casually behind her. You guys know, she said, how sometimes maybe someone is a great musician or something, and well, maybe he plays the trumpet or something really well, and then maybe he has a kid, and it turns out the kid isn't any good at all at playing the trumpet. Her parents looked puzzled. No, said her father, what on earth are you talking about? She tried again. Well, suppose the guy is a terrific basketball player, and maybe he plays for the Celtics, and he's almost 7 feet tall. Then maybe he has a kid, a little boy, and maybe the little boy wants to be a great basketball player, but he only grows to be 5 feet tall, so he can't be any good at basketball, right? Is this a riddle, Anastasia? Her mother asked. It seems very complicated. What if a man is a really good poet, and his daughter tries to write a poem, I mean, tries really hard, and the only poem she can write is a terrible poem? Oh, said her father, let me see the poem, Anastasia. Anastasia handed the poem to her father. He read it once to himself. Then he read it aloud. He read it the way Anastasia had tried to in class, so that some of the words sounded long and shuddery. When he came to the word night, he said it in a voice as quiet as sleep. When he had finished, they were all silent for a moment. Her parents looked at each other. You know, Anastasia, her father said finally, some people, actually a lot of people, just don't understand poetry. It doesn't make them bad people, her mother said. Just dumb, said Anastasia. If she could change why I don't like Mrs. Westvessel, the answer because I'm dumb to because she's dumb, maybe it wouldn't be such a discouraging question and answer after all. But her father disagreed. Not dumb, he said. Maybe they just haven't been educated to understand poetry. He took his red pen from his pocket. I myself, he said grandly, have been very well educated to understand poetry. With his red pen, he added some letters to the F so that the word fabulous appeared across the top of the page. Anastasia decided that when she went back to her room, she would get her green notebook out again and change page 2 once more. I wrote a fabulous poem, it would say. She smiled. Daddy, do you think maybe someday I could be a poet? She asked. Don't know why not, he said, if you work hard at it. Why are you so quiet? Did Mrs. Westvessel do the right thing? Anybody? Who said no? Why not?
Because she degraded her class.
One mistake. Is there any other? Usually when I ask this, half the people think she didn't pay attention. Is there anything else that she did wrong?
Yeah. Well, the child had obviously been watching thinking and deep thinking, and she didn't recognize that at all.
So what should she have done? Does anybody know what she should have done? Well, I'm back up this morning.
What should have she done? How many of you agree that she didn't do the right thing? Most of you agree? Then what should she have done? What would you do?
I think she should have recognized what type of poem she had written and like given her respect to her as a person and said that, you know, that this was a good poem, but maybe gotten the right one in the style that she wanted.
Sure, would that have been a big deal? So, you know, that showed a lot of imagination, didn't it? But that really isn't the kind of poem we were after. And I appreciate you writing that. I'm going to give you a chance to write another one. That's all she'd had done, right? Now, maybe a more important question.
How many times do you think that kind of scene goes on, even in Christian schools? Way too many. I could cry when I think about it. That's one of my favorite stories. You know, and I've had to learn this the hard way, and it's a very simple thing. There is never an excuse for not being kind. Period. Now, you have those. Anybody have any questions? We could read stories, but we're not going to read any more probably today. There's all kinds of literature, obviously. And we are just going to take the ones that we have there as the classifications, the genre for literature. If you'll look on your outline under session one, historical novels, James Michener would be famous. How many of you have ever read any James Michener? Fantastic books. Historical novels, I put Lewis L'Amour there. Somebody has a Lewis L'Amour book. Who has one? Have you ever read one? There was some objectionable material in those books, but you'll learn an awful lot of history. Very realistic. In Michener's books, historical novels, somebody has one, Pontius Pilate. Who has Pontius Pilate? You ever read that book? I read that book probably four or five times. Terrific book. A historical novel of those kind. Another one would be The Day Christ Died. Does somebody have that? Do I have that here? I thought I had that here. The Day Jesus Was Born, is that here? One of them, you have that. Those are written by the same person, The Day Christ Died. Anybody ever read those? Ever? I think every date, town, person's name in there. I think it's that one. Is true. Or is that another book? But then he weaves the story around those. So they're very, very, they're not fiction. You couldn't call them fiction. Very interesting books. Tremendous way to learn history. The trouble is many of those books, now not the religious ones, but like Lewis L'Amour and James Michener, there's always going to be some things in them that you would prefer maybe were not in them. So I'm interested in seeing what you do with that. I think I have Hawaii here. Who has Hawaii? That's a good book. Biographies, that would include autobiographies, meaning the person wrote it themselves, and there's several of those out there. Do you realize the problem with all it? My definition of literature, and I think I bring that up, maybe we will now, but all written material is literature. You can call it bad literature or whatever you want. But in a way, all written material is literature because it influences people. And that's kind of my definition, and we're not going to hassle about it. I mean, it doesn't matter. But anything that's written is written for a purpose, and it influences people. But you have to realize that the past, here I am, wait a minute. The past is what happened. No question about it, right? The past is what happened. What men wrote about it is history. And the core of all of that is that it's always going to be tainted. Except the Bible. Everything except the Bible, you have to realize when you read it, is going to be tainted. Now, maybe not maliciously so. You see what I'm saying? Maybe not to any... Somebody didn't have a program and they're trying to twist your mind or tell you something isn't true, but it's always going to be tainted. because the person's view, even if he was there, of what happened is always limited. He never sees, I don't care if you watch a house burn down, you never see and know everything that happened. You know, and there's many, many examples of that. Somebody says, well, I was there and I saw this accident. And somebody else says, well, I was there and saw the accident. And they give the account of it. And the policeman says, are we talking about the same one? Because they saw things different. They didn't all hear the same thing. They didn't all see the same things. They stand in a different direction. All kinds of things. So you have to remember, except for the Bible, everything you read, even if it's an account like, what's the name of that one? Gifted Hands. I mean, there's no reason for, I think that's as accurate account as it can be. But that doesn't mean that it's everything in there is portrayed. That's a true story. How many of you ever read that book, Gifted Hands? That is one fantastic book. And so that's a true story. But you aren't going to necessarily get the whole story just by the nature somebody wrote it. So biographies, even though they're biographies, a realistic fiction. Now, what I mean by that, I used the Bobbsey twins there. There's piles of that. You could say that some of those historical novels are, but realistic fiction would fall under the category of stories that are very realistic. For instance, For One Moment. Who has that book? That's fiction, right? I mean, if you haven't read that book? Most of you have probably read that book, right? How many of you have read that book? I mean, isn't that fiction? It was pretty realistic, isn't it? I mean, if somebody told you it was true, wouldn't you believe it? No, I would have believed it if they'd have said this is a true story. It's true enough that I would have believed it. And it's true in that it's based on fact, but it's a fiction story. Heavy message. Interesting reading. Christian fiction, I use Charles Sheldon's In His Steps. Do I have an In His Steps here? I can't remember what all. You have that. You've never read that before? And then I have another one of Charles Sheldon's, The Crucifixion of Philip Strong. Who has that? You have that? Good story. It's fiction, but it's got a very heavy Christian message to it. Personification, I just picked on Benjamin Bunny. There would be a lot of those. Personification would be having animals or things talk that can't talk. And in my quiz I gave you, I have that on there. Do you realize that in Judges 9 that very thing happens? The story of the bushes talking. So we have to be careful. My first reaction to that is that's not realistic. But then I realize there's many examples in the Bible. I mean, the Psalms talks about the hills dancing. I don't know how that happens, but you know, there's been a lot of speculation on what that means. The hills singing and the trees singing. I mean, there's all kinds of personifications in the Bible. So if you say, well, you know, personification is objectionable, well, it's part of the Bible you're not going to read. True story. They're just accounts of what happened. And I put down there those. And how do some of you, Barbara Ann, she's met these people. Boese. How do they say that, Sam? Bays. They're Mennonite people that live in Canada. How many of you ever read any of those books? Met the people? Know them? What's her name? Sam and Lucy? Huh? Louise Bays. Interesting stories. And there's a lot of them. Many, many of them. So what I would like for you to do, and I'm jumping ahead now, I didn't know how this would go, but it's good to do, because I would like for you to get started reading those books. And all I want you to do is to read them, and if you can look at section 2, think about, go ahead and read them, and then you can think about these things. That's the six things there you're going to be looking for when you read them. Now, in the case of like King Henry the Fourth, who has that? King Henry the Fourth, Shakespeare. You know any Shakespeare? You'll love it. See, there's phrases in there
that you hear, and this is a big debate among Christian people, well, not among secular people. Is there any value in reading Shakespeare? And we'll get into that when we get into the criteria. I don't know what you're going to come up with. I'm going to, for this session at least, I'm going to live with whatever you come up with. But there's a lot of sayings, there's a lot of things in our culture that have to do with Shakespeare. In that King Henry IV, and you don't need to read the whole thing, but you ought to read, you know, 100 pages of it. And have somebody else help you understand it. But this, the main character in it is named Hal. And he Shakespeare has him make a statement. You know, Shakespeare took actual characters. It was a King Henry IV. He was in these battles and in all these things. Julius Caesar's another of Shakespeare's things. Many, many of them. But in that Shakespeare, Hal says, he kind of plays the fool in the beginning of it. He's kind of the playboy, and he makes a statement. I'll so offend, to make offense a skill, redeeming time when men think least I will. Now you think about that a long time, and I'm going to tell you what all that means. We'll kind of figure it out, but we'll probably talk about it later. And that's kind of the key, you'll see that phrase. I'll so offend, to make offense a skill, redeeming time when men think least I will. And in that play, he does that. You have to get used to Shakespeare. Some people say that the King James Version of the Bible, because Shakespeare lived in that same time, is Shakespeare, but that's not really true. Because the King James Bible is much easier to read than Shakespeare. And the truth of the matter is, that the King James Bible was written in the time of Shakespeare, but the version of the King James Bible that we read today, I think, is the sixth revision. It might be the fourth or something, but instead of calling it a revision and giving it another name, they just kept calling it the same name. You see what I mean? And so to say that the King James Bible is written in the literary motif of 1611 is not true. So as you read these, and if any of the rest of you, if some of those are, you know, overwhelming in their volume, talk to me about it. You may not have to read the whole thing to get the tenor of it and whether you can make a judgment on the book or not. But what you need to look for is what might qualify it for good literature, and tomorrow we will develop that. And what might not, why it might not qualify as good literature. I want you to be specific. I read this book, or I read half of it, if it's Hawaii, if it's Shakespeare, or whatever it is, and I think this is good literature because, be specific, one or two reasons. Or I think that it's not good literature because you need to have an actual quote in there. You know, I object to whatever. We need to do that. We need to learn to do that as teachers in what we read. And so then you need to come to a conclusion. You say, well, I didn't really like this part of it. I really liked this part of it. I guess it's a book that I would read to my class, but I wouldn't recommend they read it themselves. Because you realize it was just a matter of a phrase here and there or a word here and there. You know, when you're reading it to a class, you can change a word, leave it out, and they don't know the difference. I've done that many times. As long as they don't read the book and find out that's what you did. What type is it? And the type I'm talking about is a historical novel, biography. Where would you classify it? And some of them are obvious, some of them aren't. And then determine the reading level. And we'll talk about that right now, after we think about, and read one gem. Just say, for instance, here's a paragraph or three sentences or whatever that's typical of this story that really caught my eye or my heart, whatever you call it. Is that too much? This is a non-credit class, right? So you don't need to do anything. You want to, is that right?
Depends
on how much you want to get out of it. I'm interested in seeing this book here, my friend. When did you read that book?
course start. Child course start. Five Christian people object to this book. I don't know, hoping you'll touch the choir. You don't like horse stories, sir. I bet you can trade somebody.
No.
Nor did I. I read it twice, at least.
Any questions about that? What you're going to do with this? So you can start reading already. You can do this. Is that too complicated? Too simple? What are you thinking, Wendell? Or are you thinking? Now, how many of you have ever, like a Gunning Fog Index, to know just roughly what the reading level of a book is? How many of you have ever done that? Okay. Very simple. Doesn't take long. And it's not, you know, it's not a scientific, it's a rule of thumb. I'll see without looking up. You'll need to write this down. You need to read full sentences. So if you come to a full sentence at 98 words, you quit. You have to go to 105 words to come to a full sentence. That's what it's called. You got it? So you read this, then you read 105 words. But you don't stop part of the sentence. So you read the full sentences as close to 100 as you can. Is that clear enough? That's complicated. That's something you do. So you read, and the end of the sentence came at 103 words. We'll just use this as a made-up example. You count the sentences, and there's six of them. Six sentences. So you get the average words per sentence. So you divide those. And how much is that? Anybody have a calculator? You divide this, you're going to get 1/7, right? 17.2. And this isn't 17.1, 17.2, 17. It doesn't matter. You can call it 17 if you want. Then you count, and this is a little bit tricky. But again, it's no big deal. Then you count the polysyllable words. Can you read this back there? Thing doesn't write on here real good. Words. Meaning, 3 or more syllables. Now, an ing or an ed or that kind of thing makes it a 3 syllables, you don't have to. If a word, if it's a proper noun and it comes up twice, let's say, what's it? What? You probably only count once. If it's in there 4 times, you're going to count twice. It's not a real exact thing. Now you add those, add number 4 to the words per sentence. So let's just, for ours, let's say there was 70. Now we add 7 to this, we get 24.2. Is that right? Did I do it right? Now you multiply
I mean, this is all the math there'll be in this class. Now you multiply by 0.4. And 4 times 24 is going to be what? Nobody's a math student? Huh? 96. So it's 9th or 10th grade. That's all there is to it. Is that too complicated? If you have trouble with it, let me help you. Now, I need to caution you. It's easy. You pick up a book and you wonder if this is a 4th grade book or a 6th grade book. And if you just open the book and just wherever it's convenient. Don't do it in the beginning. Just open the book up anywhere and do this. And I did this back in Ohio for my nephew, and it was a child's book. It was like 4th or 6th grade book. And the section that we took, it ended up it was like 8th grade. Well, I knew that's not what it was. And it's because we just happened to pick a section that had some long sentences in it. So it made a lot of words per sentence. So we just took another section of the book. Just picked another section, and it come out 5th grade or something, which is about what we thought it should. And so, don't just hang your hat on just going through it once. If it doesn't look right, seem right, try 2 or 3 places. That's just a rule of thumb. Pretty close. But depending on the author, if they tend to use long sentences or whatever, you can throw it a little bit off. Most publishers of curriculum today are pretty good about putting an age level, which I really appreciate. You know, this is for 6th grade, 5th grade, whatever it is. But a lot of people don't, and sometimes it's hard to know. You don't want to be reading over their head. And maybe tomorrow I will give you an example of those. Now, do you have any other questions? Anything? Any suggestions you want to make? Whatever. Some of you will have something that you want to read, and actually, if you want to look ahead, even tomorrow, if some of you say, hey, I read this book and I'd like to do my oral report on it. I don't know how much time we'll have. I had no idea how many students there would be. The more of you that could do at least one of those books, the better. Now, I tried to put a little heavier book with a very easy one, and you can see some of those are little kid books, like those clockwork, square clockwork. Oh, right there's one. These books are, I think, pretty easy to read that. So she might want to read the whole thing to us. But these are neat books. And one lady I talked to that works in a preschool thing, every day they have a whole bunch of these in their school, and every day they just get them all up and throw them away. Or clean and effective. And I thought the print might not really come off them, but they didn't see it from there. I mean, they look very, very easy. Every day, you throw it away. So it's something different, because a little child, and it has to do with the attitude that we portray about a book. He says, oh, no, be careful of that book. Don't touch that book. You're going to tear it. And predicting the idea of books, no. Well, what about the idea of no. And so if they're cloth books, and I don't know when these things came out, I didn't know that much about them. I think they're good ideas. Don't write the book all in one. Yeah, so they're going to carry it. Last forever.
That kind of thing. I don't know if there's a message in that book or not. You can read it and see. Be looking for the idea. I got to stay behind this thing. Be looking for the idea, and I hadn't thought about this, and this has to do with age level. Here's a book, and somebody has the Toddler's Bible. Who has the Toddler's Bible? Toddler's Bible. And a Toddler's Bible, they do a good job with that, and that's just what it is a Toddler's Bible. So when they tell the story of the flood, they don't emphasize everything being killed.
They emphasize the grace of God and how God saved Moses, Noah and his family. That's what a little child needs to know. They need to know, and isn't it true that a person that knows the judgment and the consequential part of God and doesn't know the love of God, they have an unbalanced view of God. The first thing that a child needs to know is about the love of God. Then when the time is ripe, they can understand how God deals out judgment. And I heard a lady talk, and she said when she was a little girl, she was told the story of the flood, and the part she remembered, because she said that's what they emphasized, was how everything died. And so all her life she was scared to death of rain, because she connected rain with the flood and everything dying. And so in a child's book, they need to emphasize. The same would be true with a lot of other things. David and Goliath. In a child's book like that, you don't want to emphasize that David took the sword and chopped his head off and the blood went everywhere and he carried the head back to... That's not what you want to emphasize. You want to emphasize how David trusted God and God took care of him. There's a time when they can learn and it's okay. So on those children's books, you know, that's the kind of thing that you need to look at, particularly the Bible stories. Are they putting in the child's mind the right thing? And it opens up this deal that, you know, some people think, oh, children's books? Now, anybody can write children's books. In fact, Mark Twain said anybody can write any book. The words are all in a dictionary. But there's more to it than that. It turns out there's a lot more to it than that. How many of you ever tried to write a book? It's a lot of work. It's more, isn't it? Never finished it. Well, it's not easy to write a first grade book just because it's a first grade book. It's interesting to me, on the plane out here, I'm sat next to this woman, and she used to be in advertising, and she decided she wanted to stay home, so she's making jewelry now, and she's writing children's books. And when she found out that I had done some editing and all that, we struck up quite a conversation. And with her, even, she had some of the drafts of these books. She has two boys. The oldest one's name's Gabriel. And so the first book that she's writing and working on, the name of it is Gabriel is No Angel. And in it, she uses all the things that Gabriel does wrong. And you'd say, well, that's kind of negative. But she uses those to show, she was a Christian woman, quotes, to show how his parents love him anyway. Gabriel breaks the dishes. His parents love him anyway, and through the whole book. And so the message of the book is even if you make mistakes, God loves you anyway. Good message. Huh? And she spins all that around her oldest son, Gabriel. He's no angel. Second book, her second son's name is Will. And the name of that book is Where There's a Will, There's a Way. And her son Will is clumsy. He's not retarded, but he has a hard time with his motor skills. He tends to drop things, and he can't learn to do things with his hands real well, but he finds a way to do them. And his parents love him anyway and help him. And here's an adult woman, and she said, well, it'll probably be, I mean, it's not going to be within a year. I mean, she's figuring on working two or three more years on these books. And you think, well, here she has the subject. She knows what she's doing. She knows the boys. But it's a lot of work. If you don't believe it's a lot of work, writing a book for a first grader, try it. You'll find out. Because there's a lot more to it than what you might think. And so if you're writing a book, like particularly with Christian, how are you going to write a book about whatever and put a Christian moral to it? Have a moral to it. Have a theme to it that's planting something in the child's mind that will turn him to God. Not easy. Not easy. And later on we will share some of those schemes to do that.
So there isn't time today to get into this jigsawing, but I want you to be thinking about, because what we're going to do tomorrow is we're going to break up into little groups, and then we'll combine those groups and keep combining until we end up with one criteria for acceptable reading for Christian youth. That's the goal. Now, does anybody want to share anything? I don't really want to get started on that today, and I didn't know how this would turn out. Anybody? That I read, it said, Winston Churchill used everything from Donald Duck to Jesus Christ to win an argument. He knew it all. I mean, he'd read everything. And it just shows that the spectrum of knowledge that can be useful is very, very broad. Very, very broad. In fact, how many picked up from Peter Hoover yesterday? Did I mention that, what he said? Remember what he said about an island? The larger the island of knowledge, the longer the shoreline of wonder. How many of you heard that? I wrote it down. I thought that's fantastic, because I know that's true. That's true. The more you learn, the more you want to learn. I have a story here about Elsa Dinsmore was my idol. And it's this lady wrote it and tells how these books about girls influenced her life. I have one here about the messages that there are in books. And one of them, I think, has to do with Heidi. Forget the three books here. The Wind. Oh, Bambi. Has to do with Bambi. Now, see, you take a book. Do I have a Bambi book here? Does anybody have a Bambi book? You have it. You take a book like Bambi, and you think, oh, that's just a little animal story, and there's no meaning to it. Do you know there's a subtle message behind the book of Bambi? And it has to do with relationships. Who did Bambi want desperately want a relationship with? The stag, his father. See, there's a heavy message in that, quote, simple book. Most people read the book. They don't get it. It's just fun to read. But there's a message there. And I think the person that wrote it knew that message was there. They didn't just write about a deer and trotting through the woods. There was a message. And once you're aware of that, almost anything that you read, is very rare that you'll read something that doesn't have a message to it. Fairly short story, and then who wants to lead in a closing song? Who volunteered to do that? Todd did it before. Somebody do that? Anybody? Okay, thank you. The light in the window. I met him first on a summer day in 1936. I'd rushed into his dingy little shop to have new lifts put on my slipper heels. He greeted me cheerily. You're new in this neighborhood, aren't you? Yes, I admitted. I'd moved into the apartment house at the end of the block only a week before. This is a fine neighborhood, he said. You'll be happy here. I sat there in my stocking feet, watching as he removed the old lifts and with a sad tut-tut examined the leather-covered heels, now worn through by a too-long-delayed repair job. I grew a little impatient, for I was rushing to an appointment. Please hurry, I begged. He looked at me reproachfully over his steel-rimmed spectacles. Now, lady, we won't be long. I want to do a good job. You see, I have a tradition to uphold. We heard a lot the last 2 days about tradition. A tradition? In this drab little shop without a thing to distinguish it from so many other cobbler shops on the streets of New York? He must have sensed my surprise, for he smiled as he went on. Yes, lady, I inherited a tradition.
My father and my grandfather were shoemakers in Italy, and they were the best. My father always told me, son, do your best on every shoe that comes into the shop and be proud of your fine work. Do that always, and you'll be doubly blessed, both happy and prosperous. As he handed me the finished shoes, he said, these will last a long time. These are good leather. I left in a hurry, late for my appointment, yet with a warm and grateful feeling. On my way home, I passed the little shop again. There he was, bending over his last. To my surprise, he waved cheerily. Thus began a rewarding friendship. Those were disturbing years of depression and war. Daily, as I passed his shop, we exchanged a friendly hand wave. At first, I went in only when I had repair work to be done, but then I found myself dropping in occasionally just for a chat. He was quite stooped from long years of toil. His hair was thin and gray, and his face deeply lined. But I remember best his fine brown eyes, alive with kindness and humor. I remember how they flashed one day at the mention of Mussolini, the dog, he said. It was the strongest word I ever heard him use. He was proud of his U.S. citizenship and everything American. Once shortly after Pearl Harbor, when I complained of our slow-moving preparations for war, he looked at me in amazement. But we're only getting started, he said. We have the finest men and we'll have the biggest machine. We'll do all right. We have great tradition. He was the happiest man I've ever known. Often as he stood in his shop window, hammering away at his last, he sang lustily. The Italians in our neighborhood called him La Douce alla Finestra, the light in the window. Once as we talked, he turned to wave cordially to a passerby, then said to me, there's a man I'd like to know. He's been passing here for years. I wish he'd stop in sometime, for he's a fine-looking man. I did not tell him that I knew the man, but a week later he told me, I was right about that man. He stopped in yesterday, and we had a fine talk. There's a good man, if you ever saw one. I knew then that the honesty and goodness of this gentle shoemaker had warmed another heart as it had mine, thawing a natural reserve to let kindness shine through. Children, our sidewalk sprouted them, swarmed through his shop. They were always welcome. He would chuckle over their quarrels and often stop his work to act as peacemaker if a fight was imminent. One day I came away from my apartment angry and disgusted because of a sloppy job the painters had done. My friend waved to me as I went by, so I turned into his shop for solace. He let me rant about the incompetence and inefficiency of present-day workmen. They had no pride in their work, I argued. They didn't even want to work, just wished to collect their high wages and loaf. He agreed. There's a lot of that kind around, sure, but maybe they're not entirely to blame. Maybe their fathers had no pride in their work. That's a tough on a kid. It deprives him of something important. What can be done about it, I asked. He waited a minute before answering, then looked at me squarely. There is only one way. Every man or woman who hasn't inherited a prideful tradition must start building one. In this great country, where our wonderful freedom allows us to make individual contribution, we must make it a good contribution. No matter what sort of work a man does, if he gives it his best each day, he's starting a tradition for his children to live up to, and he's making lots of happiness for himself. I went abroad for a few months. After my return, I walked down the street looking forward eagerly to his surprise. When he saw me, there was no light in the window. The door was closed. There was a little card. Call for shoes at the laundry next door. I went into the laundry full of apprehension. Yes, the old man had suffered a stroke 2 weeks ago right there in his window. He had died a few days later. We sure miss him around here, the laundryman said. He was so happy all the time. I went away with a heavy heart. I would miss him too, but he had left me something, a rare bit of wisdom I shall always remember. If you have inherited a prideful tradition, you must carry it on. If you haven't, then start one. And probably more than anything else in our society today, even among our own youth, this idea of work or lack thereof is a big problem. I'll speak for the ones I know. And they need to be continually encouraged to enjoy work and do a good job. And that starts at school. And that's, I think, one of the greatest responsibilities as teachers that we have. And you know, the greatest motivation you can have to make a child enjoy work? Anybody. What is it? Enjoy it yourself. I mean, if they don't perceive that you like to teach and that you come there just can hardly wait till the day starts, they'll pick it up. They'll pick it up. That's okay. It's not okay.
And that's one thing that we can do. And that's why they say that every book about teens that was written after Horatio Alger wrote his books is an influence either by Horatio Alger or Mark Twain. And that saying up there is Mark Twain's. How many of you ever read a Horatio Alger book? There's over 100 of them. And I have 2 or 3 of them out here. Who has one to read? Right there. And they all have one theme. Work hard, be honest, and you'll be successful. They are not necessarily Christian. But they say there was nothing. And Horatio Alger was born about 1832. He wrote his books right around Civil War time, post-Civil War time. And said that one man who wrote over 100 books had a profound effect on the youth and the work ethic of America. The books that boys read today, they don't extol that work ethic. They don't extol that honesty. And we need to promote that, and we can do that through books. We can do it through stories like that. And we have that responsibility. We have that dispensation from God. What a person eats is what he becomes physically. But what he reads is what he becomes spiritually. That's why God says it's important that you learn to read and you learn to read the Bible and understand it. Read it in truth.
It's interesting what you say there, because every day comics are read about every day. And the ratio of laziness and getting to work late is high percentage.
Mm-hmm.
I just know that the more they get older, Bobby's either, or the dag one either, trying to make the work, or else he's on the sofa doing it all the time.
Or sleeping at work. Yeah.
So that is the author trying to, is the writer trying to push that, or I'm not sure.
I don't know. I didn't bring it along because I can't find it. I've loaned it to somebody. But do you know there's more than one book on the philosophy behind Charles Schulz's Peanuts? Have any of you seen those? You've noticed how many times he inserts scripture into those? I mean, I don't take the paper, I don't read them, but when I get a chance, I look at Peanuts. Because there's some heavy philosophy, theology, in it. And there's a whole book, I think there's more than one of them, I have one of them, on the philosophy, theology, behind the Peanuts cartoon. He has a program.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.